So I want to be talking about some recent work we've done at the EPFL in the CQSL group on modeling fermions in continuous space. So since there were a couple of talks before me that introduced like why this is interesting, I've deleted a couple of my first slides and just tried to dive right into it. So just to set a bit the scene is to this is what I want you to imagine what I want to solve. So I want to solve in continuous space, not in second quantization. I want to work in first quantization. And I want you to imagine this Hamiltonian with some kinetic term for the electron, some electron-electron interaction, and then a background, a positive background of nuclei. And these will be, in the cases that I'm looking at, actually homogeneously distributed through space. And what I want to specifically, solve, I want to solve this equation, but only to the electronic degrees of freedom. So I wanted to find this wave function that represents the ground state that only depends on really explicitly on the positions of the electrons. For this, I would like to use these powerful methods that we have available now, being neural networks, specifically neural network quantum states that I'll abbreviate with NQS in my slides. But it's these things have been developed for spin degrees of freedom, so it's not a priori clear what we actually have to do in order to make this valid for fermions. The first thing we have to do is we have to make sure that our wave function is anti-symmetric. So whenever we permute two particles, we need to generate a minus sign, so we cannot just take whatever neural network we have available. We have to do some bigger effort. So in order to get some inspiration, you basically look back into how people have done this for years and years or decades. So let's build this up step by step. The easiest way to work to model fermionic degrees of freedom is to simply say, well, we have a bunch of orbitals that take single particle positions as an input, and you plug them into the state determinant, and then whenever you permute two particles, you generate a minus sign. Of course, the way that I've represented it here is that these orbitals, phi, they depend only on a single coordinate. So you can also imagine that things like correlations are not really taken into account. So how do we make this more expressive? Right, and DeLuo spoke about this this morning. So the first thing we can do is we can multiply this anti-symmetric form by something that is symmetric. So what we would imagine like as a Jastrow factor. And this Jastrow factor really takes into account the correlations, and so this can be something very flexible as long as it's symmetric under permutations of the particle. So we can plug whatever neural network in there that is smooth, so with that we can compute the Laplacian. Now, one restriction of doing that is that even though we have an anti-symmetric times a symmetric function, so symmetry-wise we're good, we have the issue that all the zeros that are generated by this first determinant, are basically inherited the total wave function inherits also these zeros. So we have to do something with these orbitals to also make them multi-particle dependent. And so the way to do that in history since actually the 30s. Is by using backflow transformation. So to more explicitly to make these orbitals depending on the other particles as well. And so again, this, as long as we make this equivariant with respect to particle permutation symmetry, we can make these very expressive. And so what I want to talk about specifically is new architectures that we've come up with to study fermions in continuous space. So just to give a bit of insight about what I said before, to visualize it a bit, this is some figure that I took from a talk from 15 years ago even, so these things have been around for a long time. So imagine that I start, I take n electrons and I basically sample n minus one positions and I look at what does the wave function look like for this one electron that I move around in space. On the left-hand side, you see what the wave function looks like for the purely the Slater case, so the Hartree-Fock case, where those lines sort of indicate where the zeros are. If you now multiply this with the Jastrow, you see that the color sort of changes, but it doesn't change the nodal structure. And now the backflow with sort of changes it as well. You don't really see it clearly in that picture, but in the last picture you see clearly that in this original location, the green lines is where they were in the Hartree-Fock case, and you see that the backflow sort of moves these nodal surfaces around. So if you're really going for very accurate ground states or excited states, you need backflow transformations. But there's many different ways of doing backflow transformations. It's been introduced in in different forms. And specifically what I would like to do now is sketch a sort of proof that if you don't change the orbitals maybe, but if you simply move the particle positions around, so you take your original electron positions and you sort of transform them to a quasi-particle system, that it represents your ground state well. So, think about imaginary time evolution. So what we do, in essence in variation Monte Carlo is we take some initial state phi of zero, which, I'm guaranteeing that it's, overlapping with the actual ground state psi zero. We don't know how much, but it needs to have an overlap. And if you write down explicitly the imaginary time evolution, you see that you get this integral equation, which we can use the mean value theorem for to actually represent this full bounded integral by a single value that now depends on x. And what you see is that the result of this says that there is a sort of system y that depended on this original set of electrons x, that if we simply transform it from x to y, we get new coordinates. We can just plug it into our whatever Hartree-Fock ansatz that we started from the start. And this tells us that yes, if we do imaginary time evolution, as long as we have this overlapping state, that we will be able to represent it simply by using coordinate transformations times a Chastel factor. So I want to dive a bit into an architecture that we've come up with, because there's been a few in the last few years, in the last 3 years or so, people have introduced some architectures, but I want to convince you that what we have is much better than what is available out there. So let me walk you through it. So again, I want to go from some electron coordinates and I want to basically transform into quasi-particle coordinates. So imagine that I have my electrons on these blue dots and I have information also on the edges between them, like relative distance and relative spin. And essentially we're going to do a bunch of transformation that iteratively improves encodings on these edges and on these nodes. And the way that we do that is going through a whole bunch of transformations. So we take the edge information, we filter out key and query pairs, and then we basically let two electrons interact with each other, so I and J in those Q and K matrices. And from the point of view from a third electron L, we sort of let them communicate the information. Once we have that available, we use it as a filter for information coming from that edge. And this generates what we call the messages M. Now, with these messages, we can do two things. We can simply update the information on these edges again, so the same like we do on the graph neural networks, and you now get a sort of abstract encoding of the interaction between two electrons I and J. We can iterate that again, plug it into the beginning, and sort of do this multiple times. But what we can also do is now start communicating this information around. So we can pass these messages M around, and every electron I gets basically all the information from all the electrons to them, and it can update its own state. Once we've done through this complicated transformation, we project it back into the original space that we want to work in, three dimensions. We're thinking about a three-dimensional gas. And we plug it, we add the original coordinates to it. This gives me now this backflow transformation that I was talking about, right? This function y of x. And we just plug it into the Hartree-Fock wave function that we started off from. So I went a bit fast over this, but the details don't matter that much. Look at the paper if you're interested. So this is a bit of a summary, again, of what I'm doing. I define a set of mean field orbitals. In this case, it's even plane wave orbitals because I'm looking at a sort of periodic system in continuous space with a well-defined momentum k. I define these complicated backflow transformations that take the original positions, transform them into abstract quasi-particles, and those are then plugged into the Slater determinant that I introduced in the beginning. Okay, so I want to apply this to the homogeneous electron gas as a first example. So the homogeneous electron gas has a Hamiltonian like the one I introduced before, and I simply want to focus on this on the electronic part. And so based on what we actually plug into the network, so I abstractly said that we start from this network of interactions and electrons themselves, we can choose what we actually feed into a network. First of all, it has to be periodic input, so we always take our coordinates and we put them through some cosine-sine transformations, but we don't let it depend on the positions of the particles themselves. And if we do that, we can actually make the full system translation invariant, and this has actually never been done before in these kind of neural transformations. On top of that, the Hamiltonian doesn't depend on the spin symmetry, and we actually make our system completely spin symmetric by only feeding it in the relative spin. We also don't bias our simulations because what we're looking for is whether a system can crystallize. And if we start from a simulation cell that is already in the right form of what this crystal should look like, you can imagine that, you know, what you plug in is what you get out, is you get a crystal in this form. Furthermore, compared to other methods that are available in the field, like they have millions of parameters, we can, you know, bring it down to 20,000 parameters. Why is this relevant? It's relevant because we can use, you know, powerful methods that have, again, been available in variational Monte Carlo for quite some time, being stochastic reconfiguration, which is sort of the quantum version, let's say, of natural gradients. And this really allows us to go from, you know, other work that needs 500,000 iteration steps to something that converges extremely rapidly in 500 steps. So about the phase diagram, let's say, of the homogeneous electron gas, let me just interpret a bit this Hamiltonian and see what we can expect. I've written everything in terms of RS, and so RS is sort of, to imagine it, it's the radius of the volume that every particle has available. So the bigger RS, the lower the density. And so if we go to high density, just from looking at the Hamiltonian, we see that we will get, you know, a kinetic turn that dominates at low RS, and then if we go to low densities, we get that the kinetic term gets killed and it's only the potential term that survives. So there we can expect something that looks crystal-like. In particular, what we expect is a floating crystal. Floating crystal is something where the one-body density is just homogeneous, but you only see a crystal structure in the two-body density. And so these are some comparisons with other methods that are available, like the Fermi-Net is a quite powerful one from DeepMind. For small systems, so just as a reference, like the zero here is our model, and then everything is plotted with respect to that. All these other models can go up to like something like 40 particles, maybe 27, I think, is the most otherwise. And you see that we do very well when it comes to predicting the ground state energy, especially if you go to higher RS. We see that, you know, we always get ground state energies that are quite competitive. Now, another thing we can do, because we keep our system so effective and really thought, you know, we sat down for a year basically and thought about every component in our network and see how we can, you know, really filter out all the essential information. And this allows us to scale up to, in this case, this is now 54 particles, and I also will show you 128 particles. And for example, LiNet, that is sort of the same like FermiNet, you see that, you know, the higher the number of particles, you see that it starts giving worse and worse ground state energies. So we do basically quite well at large RS, so low density and high number of particles. Yeah, go ahead.
Just to get a feel for the backflow, if you go back to Feynman's argument,
yeah,
he adds a momentum dependent or velocity dependent term, and there is a dipolar backflow.
And there's what?
Dipolar backflow.
Yeah.
So there it's represented by a few parameters. So is it possible to see such backflow in your approach?
Well, yeah, I mean, we want to sort of deviate from the restrictions that you have there. That's a very intuitive one, and sort of people have looked for the last whatever 30 years, let's say, into, you know, using very restricted forms where you have pair interactions only, and then maybe do some third order, you know, three-body interaction. But you usually, I keep it quite low. The nice thing about these kind of neural network approaches is that you don't have to impose this from the start, right? Because in the
it's
end,
it's multi-body to begin with.
Sorry?
So it's multi-body to begin with.
Yeah, we immediately start from multi-body, but you can choose sort of with the number of iterations that you do, which you can do, you know, with the classical backflow as well. You can do multiple iterations, but here you can very efficiently, with very few iterations, capture, you know, all body interactions.
Thank you.
Yes. Number of particles. So this is 14 particles. Yeah, sorry, I should have made that clear. So 14 particles, 90 particles. So just small systems where, you know, many of these methods, they are extremely computationally expensive because, like I said, they have millions of parameters. So optimizing it is expensive. And so, it's the zero line always. So yeah, that's what that's what I mentioned. Like the zero line is always ours. So everything is relative to our method. Yeah. I mean, there, for example, you see that maybe Fermi-Net goes down a bit, but there it's, you know, you have finite size effects on such small systems. And what I actually want to point out is, you know, there was a big claim, for example, recently that while people expected for years that this transition from liquid to a crystal happens at RS equal to 110, by these, you know, keeping the system size small, you actually see it. I mean, they claim that it was at 2 or at 5, which was, you know, quite a big claim compared to everything that was believed before. But if you, you know, look at bigger systems and you make sure that you represent your ground states better, you will actually find that it lies somewhere where you expect it to be, around RS equal to 110. I don't know if that's clear. So it's, we're doing well. We only have, of course, other methods to compare with. I will also compare with diffusion Monte Carlo, actually. So here is the, so what I mentioned before is that we, compared to other methods that are available, they usually plug in the single electron positions in as well. And the downside of doing that is you know that your Hamiltonian is translation invariant. And we know also from, you know, working on spin systems that imposing symmetries on your wave functions is really crucial. Essentially, if you don't respect it, you will often converge to other you know, spurious states, let's say, that are a bit higher in energy, and you will make wrong conclusions. And so what we do show here, what I show here is the two-body density essentially of this homogeneous electron gas. And as I said before, you know, it was sort of recently believed that the crystal sort of started appearing at very high densities. We can actually now exclude this again by, you know, introducing these more scalable and more precise methods to, you know, that know that there is basically no Wigner crystal present until RS equal to 110. And this is the largest electronic simulation of, you know, the neural network quantum states, I have to say. Didn't write it explicitly, with 128 electrons. And so here I also compare to the fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo, and I think the unpolarized fluid is actually also diffusion Monte Carlo. And so what you see on that plot is, at low R, you see no particles at a certain radius, and then suddenly you see a range of particles existing, which is sort of hinting towards something that goes more and more towards a crystal structure. But like I show, if you make a computation with something that is purely a fluid simulation, you also see these bumps. And so by comparing to other results, we can also show that we don't find this Wigner crystal. Now, this is on the electron gas, as I said. Now, we also want to develop these tools. You know, now that we have these very powerful methods available for backflow transformations, we can see if we can also do more than this. And the first thing that I mentioned is, if you want to use neural networks, you have to think about how to constrain our system to be physical, so to represent fermionic degrees of freedom. And so I started from this later determinant, but something as, you know, simple, let's say, as BCS theory is hard to imagine in this framework, where BCS theory, just so you know, is like two opposite spin particles tightly binding to each other. So something like that we cannot represent in this simple form. So what we can do is we can explicitly start from two-body orbitals. So in this case, our function phi is now an orbital that depends on two particles. So sigma would be the spin here. So we have the position and the spin and position and spin of another particle. And we can decompose this odd function into two components, being the ones where the spins couple to a singlet or to a triplet. And the first one would be to a singlet, second one to a triplet. And the first one, you can show analytically that, you know, we need Pfaffians actually to represent these two-body wave functions. If you restrict yourself to only represent singlet pairs, you will actually, you know, it will be sufficient to take something like a slated determinant. Now, if you want to also include triplet pairing, then you cannot basically get around with using a slated determinant. So you need Pfaffians to accurately represent these states. So what we've introduced recently is the concept of using the neural backflow Pfaffian. And so in this case, we use these backflow transformations to transform, again, the particle's positions and its spins. But we, rather than plugging it into a slated determinant, we now plug into Pfaffian, where we have, in general, anti-symmetric functions phi. So whenever we, you know, switch the positions of these two particles or the spins, we get a minus sign. And so this can generate, in this case, an unpolarized singlet and triplet system. And so, yeah, where does this become relevant? Well, for example, if you want to study the BCS-BEC crossover, just to give a bit of information about what this crossover is about. So on the two sides, we have fermions, and sort of the colors are opposite spins. On the left-hand side, we get pairs that are bound with each other but are quite far away relative to sort of the density of the next few particles. And if we change the interaction, we go towards something where the pairs are more closely bound to each other, which are, and they are much closer compared to the next few particles. So we applied this to some system that actually generates this crossover. So I'm showing the Hamiltonian on the top left there, where we have an interaction that depends on the spin. So only we have an attractive potential between opposite spins. And what you see here, maybe let me walk you through it, is maybe let's look at the top right plot, is that if we compare the results that we're getting for the ground state energies, is that we're doing even much better than DMC results with BCS ansatz. So for those people who don't know DMC, if you're doing better than DMC, it usually means you're doing a very good job. And so we're doing that over the whole spectrum of effective ranges. You can see the same here over the different scattering lengths. So the scattering length is basically what you sort of tune if you want to go over this transition. You see that over the whole transition, we're doing better than the DMC results. So I mean, we're quite happy with these results. And now this shows us that we can use these backflow transformations that we have available and apply them to a bunch of different systems. So yeah, to finalize this work, I didn't do this alone. This is with Giuseppe and Gabriel from in EPFL and with external collaborators, Jane Kim, this should be, and Alessandro Lovato at Argonne. And I just want to mention that we have toolboxes available actually in our group, being NETCAT, where we extended this recently to also work with fermionic degrees of freedom. It was originally developed to handle spin systems. But you can use this to do variational Monte Carlo with neural networks. So if you want to play around with that, I invite you to take a look. And I'll just leave you with these references. And maybe I'll also, you know, advertise that we also did similar things with second quantization. So definitely check out those references if you're interested. Thank you.
Thank you for a great talk. So presumably you have a graph neural network type thing that works for electrons. Say you train it for a smaller system. The question is, how did am I right in assuming that the number of parameters doesn't really scale with the number of electrons?
It usually does. So for, I think, all other cases it does. But, you know, I started with this sort of, you know, sketch of a proof where that said that we can basically not change the orbitals. If you would have to change the orbitals every time you put in a new electron, you have a new orbital that you need to occupy, so you need to sort of fit this new orbital, right? We don't do it that way. We say, no, we're going to start from the Hartree-Fock orbitals, and we only are going to transform our system from an interacting system to this sort of non-interacting system through our backflow transformation, and now this only scales. It doesn't scale with the number of particles, essentially. I mean, it might be, of course, that if the physics is not the same, right, we have finite size effects and all that stuff. So if you go to bigger system size, it might be that the physics is more, you know, more challenging to capture. And then you might simply need to increase the flexibility of your ansatz. But it doesn't explicitly immediately depend on that.
Yeah, so the question was going to be, so if you train on smaller systems, is this a good initialization for the larger systems?
But yeah, like, actually, yeah, we've done this. I mean, in some of these, like in the second work, for example, we actually do this also. It's usually a good thing to do also, for example, for the BEC, for the transition, for the crossover, you can even train it also on very easy interaction strengths, and then you sort of start tuning up the potential, you know, turning it up and making it stronger and stronger, and you can even transfer learn in that direction. But in principle, yeah, you can start from smaller systems, yeah, simply because we only do these transformations of the locations.
Sneak in just one. Do hidden fermions, does adding hidden fermions in this kind of setup help anything, or have you even tried it?
The hidden fermions, well, honestly, we don't need it, so we prefer not to do it because this really introduces a bunch of extra parameters, and like I said, we sort of wanted to, you know, start from really thinking this architecture through and keeping the number of parameters low such that we can use stochastic reconfiguration or, you know, natural gradient descent to, you know, more, you know, I work in a very poor country, Switzerland, where the computational resources are very expensive. And so, yeah, we wanted to keep that low. So, but it's something we want to try.
Okay, You guys can share the yellow.
Thank you for the very nice talk. And I have a question about message passing backflow architecture. And it very looks like a graph neural network. Is there any difference between?
Well, so I mean, graph neural networks is a very vague concept. So in general, what you need for these backflow transformations is you need it to be permutation equivariant. So if you change in the input two, you know, particles from with their properties, you need to make sure that the output of this whole thing needs to sort of have the same transformation. And the thing that does that is a graph neural network. Now, it's not that you can just say, okay, I take the graph neural network and I just, you know, plug it in there. It would be great if you can do that, but there are so many design choices that you can take. I mean, it really, like I said, we spend a year basically trying to optimize this and to make sure that, for example, this particle attention that I showed where you have two electrons that, you know, through the point of view from a third electron start communicating with each other. This very efficiently takes into account the correlations, but you can, for example, skip this part and only do the message passing by itself. Without that previous information exchange, and then the results are again very bad. So it really, like, it all depends also on the features that you plug in and all that stuff. So it's not just one thing.
Okay, and I have one more question. Are electrons still fully connected when the system size increases?
So we, in our computations at the moment, we take everything talks to everything. Of course, if you want to go to really big systems, then you could think about, for example, you know, putting a sort of cutoff or so. Now, the downside of this, the tricky thing there is that our wave function needs to remain smooth because we need to compute the kinetic term, which is, you know, the Laplacian. So we need to make sure that if we start cutting things off, that it sort of doesn't, you know, go to zero. Very hard, because then you will get nonsense.
Just to make sure that I understood things correctly, once you have your neural network set up for the backflow,
yeah,
it's just regular variational Monte Carlo, right? You
yeah,
just
metropolis
or whatever it is.
From that point, you need a scalable way to do the stochastic reconfiguration, for example, which, you know, it takes a bit of thought to do this, because, you know, I think with the previous methods that were available, you had, let's say, I don't know, 100 parameters or so, and you can compute the quantum geometric tensor, and you can even, you know, compute it exact. I mean, really, and make the matrix. Now, if you know, start going to more than 10,000 parameters, for example, you need to think that through. But in principle, from that point on, it's variational Monte Carlo. Yeah.
And then there is nothing that prevents you to do DMC on top of what you are doing, right?
There's a bit of...
There is nothing that prevents you from doing diffusive Monte Carlo...
On top of it, yeah, except for cost. Yeah. It's expensive to do it on top of course, but we always try to simply compare to more simple wave functions that have, you know, like backflow. I think I showed also backflow DMC, where you start from an ansatz that has backflow and actually represents already quite well the nodal surface. But, I mean, I would say in general, okay, we make this very general backflow transformation, and in principle, there's an ambiguous definition between what is now actually a backflow transformation and what part comes from the Jastrow. I sort of showed you in the beginning that, you know, in principle, you can distinguish them, but, I mean, in reality, you cannot really do that. In our case, we for example, we don't need the Jastrow factor. But what a DMC in reality does, it makes a very expressive, let's say, Jastrow term, right? It usually cannot hop across a nodal surface. So we try to make sure that the things that we compare with is something that has been accepted for years and years, which has the right nodal structure, and then, you know, use it basically to optimize what you would get alternative from the Jastrow factor.
On the orbitals themselves, they are also parameterized, or they are just...
It depends. Yeah, I showed you a bunch of things, so there are... We describe it all in the paper, so it's a bit. You can go to these references, but I have to think whether the orbitals themselves. I think they are. Yes, I mean they are parameterized, but I don't know where exactly. I mean, this is what the people from Argonne give us, is the diffusion results, and then we sort of try to beat those with variation Monte Carlo.
Bhaskaran.
When you have a high density, you have a Fermi surface for the 2D electron gas.
Yeah.
So when you go to Wigner crystal, the Fermi surface disappears.
What the Fermi surface, what?
The Fermi surface exists for small RS or high electron density, mm-hmm. for the two-dimensional electron gas.
Yeah.
You have a Fermi surface with small modification. When you go to Wigner crystal, there is real space localization, so Fermi surface disappears. So how do you see it in the backflow picture?
We didn't dive into these things. So we're going to do a follow-up. This was to introduce the technique and you know, show that we can go up to 128 particles and do that. But now we want to do really a full scan of the phase diagram and so on and look at different observables because, you know, whether, so I didn't say whether we see a Wigner crystal, for example, at RS bigger than 110 because there's specific observables you need to compute, like the S of K, for example, you need to compute. And we want to be sure that, since it's a big claim to say whether what is exactly is present there, we want to make sure that we do it by scanning the whole diagram. We wanted to first show already that this claim that at RS equal to 2 to 5, which sounds a bit weird that you would find a crystal there, that this is something entirely due to the biasing of your simulation cell to a BCC lattice and breaking the translation symmetry and looking at small systems, essentially.
Thanks, Bhaskaran. Any other questions? And if anyone's online and has a question, pipe in now. Okay, if not, let's thank our speaker again.